Good afternoon. You're listening to Rights, Roots and Rants on Radio Blue Mountains, 89.1 FM. I'm Deborah Smith, and today in the show, we've got a great lineup. I'll be talking to John Atkins from the Blue Mountains Peace Collective about Anzac Day reflection on Anzac Day, but in the afternoon. John's in the studio with me now. We're going to do the weather first, but hello, John. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, so next Friday, that will be the 110th anniversary of the 1915 dawn landing at Gallipoli of the Australia and New Zealand Army Corps, the ANZACs. It will be the 109th time that Australians will rise in the dark to attend dawn services to honour the ANZACs and those who have served in various conflicts since then. There's no doubt that the Gallipoli campaign and World War I had an enormous impact on Australia and its people. During the Gallipoli campaign, Australian casualties totalled 8,709 dead and 19,441 wounded. Overall, it's estimated that the total number of military and civilian casualties during World War I was over 35 million, ranking it amongst the deadliest conflicts in human history. And that's according to a Blue Mountains Peace Collective media release. In mid-1914, on the eve of World War I, Australia's population was over 4.9 million. This figure included both Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. By 1911, the population was 4,455,005, with a median age of 24 years old. And I got that information from the ANZAC portal of the DVA website. According to the First World War page on the Australian War Memorial website, from a population of fewer than 5 million, 416,809 men enlisted to fight in World War I, of which over 60,000 were killed and 156,000 wounded, gassed or taken prisoner. The latest figure for those killed is given as 62,000. That's 4.4% of the population, but if we narrow it down to just men, there was a potential pool of 820,000 men between 19 and 38, the ages of 19 and 38, prior to World War I, meaning that almost 8% of young Australian men were killed and about 19% injured or taken prisoner in World War I. That's about 12% of the total male population and 27%, almost one-third of young men, with the effects of their deaths and trauma rippling out to their enemy, to their families and their communities. The Blue Mountains Peace Collective will be hosting an Anzac Day reflection at 2 p.m. on Anzac Day in the Peace Park opposite the Council Chambers in Katoomba. It's in the afternoon, so it doesn't conflict with the RSL ceremonies in the morning. And with me here today is John Atkins of the Blue Mountains Peace Collective, and we're going to consider just a different perspective of Australians at war. Welcome, John, to Rights, Roots and Rants.
Thanks for the opportunity to be here, Deb. As you mentioned, Australia suffered significant casualties during World War I, including the ill-fated Gallipoli campaign, which began in February 1915. As you pointed out, these casualties were high as a proportion of the male population at the time. So it is definitely fitting that we, as a nation, remember Australian casualties suffered during the Great War, as well as in subsequent wars and conflicts. What is questionable, however, is the manner in which we commemorate our war casualties. In particular, one can draw a distinction between genuine remembrance based on solemn reflection of all servicemen and women who perished in past wars, as opposed to Anzacry, which, in addition to honouring our war dead, seeks to promote the Anzac legend along with certain political and military objectives. As journalist Paul Daly has said, on Anzac Day, ignore politicians and sportscasters and their hyperbole. Don't get lost in their words when considering war's evil. And especially, beware politicians invoking Anzac to justify further adventurism, military purchases and strategic decisions like AUKUS.
Yes, it's right that we should reflect and remember the losses of World War I and all of the wars we've been involved in. Given the outline, I believe that Anzac Day began in 1916 as a coming together in genuine outpouring of national grief. But haven't there been some changes in the meanings attached to Anzac Day, as well as some myths born and perpetuated over the last century? Is the Peace Collective's Anzac Day reflection an opportunity to reconsider the meaning of Anzac Day and to question some of the beliefs we have about it?
Well, Deb, you're right about Anzac Day commemoration starting in 1916. The date, the 25th of April, was officially named Anzac Day in 1916 and was marked by a wide variety of ceremonies and services in Australia, New Zealand and in London. Now, one shouldn't overlook the fact, however, that during the remaining years of the First World War, Anzac Day was not only devoted to remembering our casualties during the Great War, but the government also used it to boost patriotism and its recruitment campaign for the war. Then by the mid-1930s, all the rituals now associated with the day, dawn vigils, marches, memorial services, reunions, even two-up games, they became part of Anzac Day commemorations around the country. Now, public interest in Anzac Day, however, reached its lowest point during and after Australia's involvement in the Vietnam War. In the 1960s and 70s, anti-war protesters used Anzac Day events as a platform to voice opposition to conscription and Australia's military engagement overseas. However, and this is where the change began, during the late 1980s and 1990s, there was a revival of public interest in and attendance at Anzac Day ceremonies. This revival was significantly stimulated by the major political parties. Now, you'll recall that on the 25th of April 1990, Bob Hawke became the first Australian politician to visit Gallipoli. He also decided that the government would pay for Anzac veterans to travel to Gallipoli to mark the 75th anniversary of the Dawn landing. But far more significant than Bob Hawke's intervention was John Howard's promotion of Anzac Day, what we would call Anzacary. The various strands of John Howard's promotion of Anzac Day helped transform the event and the culture surrounding it. Now, it was John Howard's political influence as Prime Minister that substantially contributed to reshaping our sense of national history and the myth that Australian nationhood was born at Gallipoli in military engagements overseas rather than as a result of civilian and political achievements at home. It's worth spending, I think, a few moments to explain the Howard government's strategy in encouraging this revival, since it doesn't get much publicity these days. What John Howard was eager to support was the expansion of war memorials, the proliferation of plaques, annual pilgrimages to battlefields, the development of war-focused curriculum materials for schools, most unusual, subsidies for literature and film production, and significantly, the endless ritual of public commemoration. Now, one effect of this manufactured public history-making was to obscure the achievements of real nation-building that ushered in and fostered Federation in 1901. It served to diminish the remarkable burst of progressive social and political reform that encompassed collectivist Australian values in a range of world historic reforms. I think it should also be noted that John Howard's promotion of the Anzac legend took place in the context and as a response to the history wars. Tired of hearing about Indigenous massacres, Howard was keen to change the subject and open up a new cultural front. He lavishly funded the Department of Veteran Affairs that inundated schools with curriculum resources celebrating Australian military operations in Europe and Southeast Asia. I would argue that Howard's legacy in this regard influenced Peter Dutton and the coalition parties to vigorously oppose the referendum in 2023, which was to order the Constitution to recognise the First Peoples of Australia by establishing an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice. May I say that this was decidedly a low act, if there ever was one, an act that helps perpetuate the disadvantage suffered by Indigenous people following endless massacres, now well documented by historians such as Henry Reynolds, and the dispossession of their land. So, to answer your question, Deb, the Peace Collective certainly regards the Anzac Day reflections as an opportunity to reconsider the meaning of Anzac Day and to question many of the myths and the falsified history that has surrounded it in recent times.
Okay, so that's... yeah, I agree completely. So we might have a quick break.
Radio Blue Mountains 89.1. Hello, this is Bronwyn Logan with Community Notice Board. Wicked, Weird and Wonderful is a series of school holiday plant workshops for children at the Blue Mountains Botanic Garden, Mount Tomar. There will be two-day sessions from Monday the 15th to Saturday the 4th of April. For details, go to botanicgardens.org.au. Applications are open for the Varuna Writers Centre 2026 Residential Fellowships. The residency is in June and July 2026 and all writers are invited to apply. There are 38 fellowships available. Applications close on Monday the 5th of May. For details go to varuna.com.au or phone 4782 5674. The monthly Magpie Upstyle Market is on Sunday, the 20th of April from 8:30 on the grounds of Lawson Public School. The market has a gourmet food section. For details and store bookings, phone 0416 652 679. The Blackheath Makers Market is holding a special event over the Easter weekend at the Blackheath RSL Hall and grounds on the corner of Station and Bundara Streets. There will be many new local stallholders on site. The Easter Bunny will visit at 11:30 on Sunday. Hot cross buns will be available and there is a craft store for children. The Katoomba Native Plant Nursery and Wild Plant Rescue Service is pleased to announce that it is still based at Clairvaux Community Centre at 14 Oak Street, Katoomba, and open from 10 to 1 on Friday and Saturday. The nursery collects and propagates Indigenous seeds and sells tube stock. The service is not for profit and is run by volunteers. If you would like your event publicised on Community Notice Board, you can email information to cnb891fm@gmail.com or via our website rbm.org.au.
Have you ever thought about writing your life story? Your real story in your own words. A story your family and future generations will cherish forever. With your life, your words, a professional writer will visit you at home, guiding you down memory lane. All you have to do is talk. We'll do the rest. Don't let your story be lost forever. Start today. Visit yourlifeyourwords.com.au. Proud station sponsor.
You're listening to Rights, Rorts and Rants with the team from Blue Mountains Unions and Community.
And I'm Deborah Smith. The time is 18 minutes past four. And I've got John Atkins from the Blue Mountains Peace Collective in the studio with me talking about the event on Anzac Day, 2 o'clock at the Peace Park, a day of reflection on Anzac Day. So, John, there's this idea that Gallipoli was our first blood sacrifice. Was that really the first time the people of Australia went to war?
No, it certainly wasn't, Deb. Prior to Australian Imperial Force fighting in World War I, the six Australian colonies offered troops to the British Empire to fight in the Second Boer War, which began in October 1899. So the Second Boer War encompasses a period of history in which the six Australian colonies federated to become the Commonwealth of Australia on the 1st of January 1901. Federation led to the creation of the Department of Defence, and 2 months later, on 1st of March 1901, the formation of the Australian Army. So given this history, the amalgamated Australian Army fought in the Second Boer War. The Australian contingents, numbering over 16,000 men, were the largest contribution among other countries from the British Empire, and a further 7,000 Australian troops actually served with other colonial or irregular units. And at least 60 Australian women also served in the conflict as nurses. Participation in the Boer War was vigorously debated in the colonial parliaments. In actual fact, overseas conflicts such as the Boer War were much more vigorously debated in the colonial parliaments than they are today in the federal parliament.
Okay.
Critics, and we can learn from this, critics of the Boer War posed the following questions. Why should Australians go to war half a world away against people who could never present a threat to our country? And why go to war in societies we know little or nothing about? Such mindless belligerence, they argued, was utterly immoral. The men who debated these questions in 1899 feared that a precedent was being created and that once the country had become a willing accomplice of imperial power, there would be no turning back. Such arguments are very relevant today, I think.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people have never heard of the Boer War. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, the Boer War's in, is it South Africa?
Yes, South Africa, yes.
So Gallipoli wasn't the first time. It's not unusual to hear that the Anzacs fought for freedom and democracy, but is that true? By Federation in 1901, three-quarters of the population were Australian-born, but we were still very loyal and connected to Britain. In fact, we were still British subjects until 1984, so within our lifetimes, and Australian citizenship didn't exist till 1949. Apart from any personal motives individuals may have had, wasn't our involvement in World War One, or also known as the Great War, really in support of king and country? And when did the real fight for Australian democracy begin, and how was it achieved?
Well, in relation to the first question, did the Anzacs fight for freedom and democracy? The short answer is no.
Yeah.
In fact, the Gallipoli campaign provides an instructive lesson in the disasters that can follow from unwavering loyalty to a great ally and a willingness to undertake alliance warfare in foreign lands. Incredibly, prior to the outbreak of hostilities, the Australian government jumped the gun on the 3rd of August 1914, cabling an offer of an expeditionary force of 20,000 men of any suggested composition to any destination desired by the Home Government. The force was to be at the complete disposal of the British government. Note that this extraordinary offer was made before the British government even decided to declare war on Germany. It is suggested that this action helped the war party in the British cabinet defeat those who were advocating against going to war. Now, it is certainly true that the new Labor Prime Minister, Andrew Fisher, did call in late 1914 for an imperial conference to take place in London to evaluate war costs and strategy. However, when London refused, he wrote back cringingly on the 15th of February 1915, saying, "When the King's business will not fit in with our ideas, we do not press them." So why the Gallipoli campaign? Essentially, the campaign aimed to win spoils for Tsarist Russia and bribe her into staying in the war. King George V got the ball rolling just 10 days into the war against the Ottoman Empire. On the 13th of November 1914, the King asked Count Berkendorf, Russian ambassador to London, to assure his cousin, Tsar Nicholas, "As for Constantinople, it's clear that it must be yours." Another objective was to lure neutral Italy into the war with the prospect of plundering Turkey. It worked. The Italians signed up for the war under the secret Treaty of London, just as the Anzacs were digging in on the 26th of April. So, a total of 8,709 of our youth were killed at Gallipoli, and a further 19,441 were wounded, all for the purpose of keeping Russia in the war, as well as to entice Italy into it. As the leading historian of Gallipoli, that's Nicholas Lambert, has written, it was all a wicked gamble. Now, across the ditch, on the 19th anniversary of the Gallipoli landings in 2005, Chief of the New Zealand Defence Forces, Air Marshal Bruce Ferguson, he said, perhaps the Gallipoli campaign was the high water mark of our nation's imperial subservience. We learned that we must shake off the shackles of colonial dependence. Unfortunately, such truths are usually avoided in official statements at our Anzac Day commemorations. As Australia's offer of an expeditionary force of 20,000 men to the British government before the outbreak of hostilities helps demonstrate, Australia's involvement in World War I, including Gallipoli, was primarily about serving king and country, about showing our unwavering loyalty to the British Empire. Now, in relation to the second part of your question, Deb, the real fight for freedom and democracy actually began in the 1840s at home, when calls to form a federation were first articulated. However, these efforts were rather hamstrung by a lack of popular support for the proposal at that time. Later in the 1890s, a number of conventions were held to develop a constitution for the Commonwealth. The journey to acceptance of a national constitution by the colonial parliaments was a difficult one. However, to cut a long and really fascinating story short, in June 1899, referendums on a revised constitution were held in all of the colonies except Western Australia, where the vote was not held until the following year. The majority vote was yes in all the colonies. This paved the way for the Commonwealth of Australia Constitution Act to be passed on the 5th of July 1900. It was given royal assent by Queen Victoria on the 9th of July of that same year. The Constitution Act was subsequently proclaimed on the 1st of January 1901 in Centennial Park, Sydney. Sir Edmund Barton was sworn in as the interim Prime Minister, who led an interim federal ministry of 9 members. So very briefly, that is how federation was achieved in peacetime and Australia's democracy established. The character and the architecture of our democracy did not result from the slaughter of Australian soldiers in foreign lands serving imperial interests.
Really interesting. It's really interesting stuff. We'll take another quick break. Let the got to pay the bills for the radio station, so just a couple more ads. So Australian democracy was developed and achieved in peacetime, well before World War One. What did the Australian democracy in 1901 look like? What did it show about our values and identity? How does this conflict with the idea that our national identity was established in wartime and that our values are military?
Okay, so on the 1st of January 1901, Australia became a federated nation with a new constitution and parliament. This marked a significant change in the country's democracy. The 6 British colonies, now states, they joined to form the Commonwealth of Australia, creating a federal system of government where powers were divided between the states and the new federal parliament. The constitution divided powers between the Commonwealth and the states, with the federal government responsible for matters affecting the whole nation, such as trade, defence and immigration. States retained their own parliaments and powers, including those over areas like education and health. It should be noted that the first federal election, which took place in 1901, was based on limited representation. In particular, women and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were largely excluded from the political process. However, this changed to a degree in 1902 when the Commonwealth Parliament passed the Commonwealth Franchise Act, which established a uniform franchise law for the federal parliament. The Act granted British subjects, male and female, over the age of 21 years, who had been living in Australia for at least 6 months, the right to vote and to stand for election to federal parliament. However, the Act excluded natives of Australia, Asia, African and Pacific Islands, other than New Zealand, from the federal franchise unless they were already enrolled to vote in an Australian state. This meant that Australia was the second country, after New Zealand, to grant women suffrage at a national level, and the first country to allow women to stand for Parliament, although subject to racial restrictions. That's quite a record. This parliamentary structure and related electoral laws provides an insight into our national identity and democratic values at the time, decidedly at odds with so-called military values. Further insights into our national identity and democratic values at the time can be gleaned from a range of progressive reforms introduced by the Commonwealth Parliament following Federation. These included the 8-hour day, a compulsory minimum wage, old age and invalid pensions, women's political rights, and the idea of a living wage and compulsory voting. So the Australian Commonwealth was born at the beginning of the 20th century with a collectivist commitment to the common good and social equality through the enactment of a series of progressive democratic measures and reforms. I think it is well to note that a number of overseas visitors came to investigate our political institutions and progressive reforms at the time. One such visitor was Professor Matthew Hammond from the United States, who applauded our pioneering social democracy. The question should be asked, aren't these achievements and world-leading reforms at the time worthy of celebrating, rather than being hidden as a result of militarising our history? How different is the real story about the founding of our nation and the values it encompassed to the falsehoods propagated by the Anzac legend, such as the nation was born at Gallipoli and our national values are military values?
Yes, as a woman, I've always had a bit of a problem of this idea of mateship, which is when Australians talk about mateship, they're talking about masculine mateship. It does exclude women, so and all those other things that you mentioned, workers' rights, collectivism, and more common good type ideas, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Yes.
So in conclusion, what are some of the hard questions that we should be asking, not only about our involvement in World War One and other wars, but in our current defence strategies? How can we protect Anzac Day status as a day of reflection and mourning, and prevent it from becoming a political tool of manipulation or as a justification for future bloodbaths?
They're really good questions, Deb. The Peace Collective would argue that asking a range of hard questions about Australia's engagement in past wars and conflicts is essential to genuine remembrance. Our argument is that we need to learn from past military tragedies so that we can minimise them occurring in the future. Surely this is an important part of honouring our war dead. Given Australia's propensity to engage in foreign wars, it is appropriate to ask the following questions. Why did we so readily go to war? What was achieved? Was engagement in our long-term national interest? And were our wars worth the huge amount of money expended and all the lives lost? An even more significant and, may I say, really asked question is this. Would we have been better off if we had avoided war? And if so, would we have been a different and more successful nation? Unfortunately, it is the case that official Anzac Day commemorations these days are designed to avoid serious consideration of such questions. What these commemorations focus on is how our servicemen and women fought, not why they fought. We examine tactics rather than strategy. And when sacrifice and heroism are invoked, as they often are, any questioning about the goals being served is pushed aside. In this context, it can never be suggested that the sacrifice of life served no justifiable purpose. Now, the same goes, as you've asked, for defence policy. There is rarely any consideration given to defining the principles that underpin an ethical defence policy in this country. For example, the following questions could be asked. Does the policy serve to defend the nation, or is it geared to serving the hegemonic interests of a powerful ally. Given Australia's membership of the United Nations, and in accordance with the UN Charter, does the policy serve to maintain international peace and security and uphold international law? Now, in the light of these standards, the US-Australia alliance can hardly be considered a force for peace and security in our region. As Paul Keating has rightfully argued, both the Coalition's and Labor's commitment to the AUKUS Pact diminishes our security and it compromises our sovereignty. Further, what justification is there in sustaining a military alliance with the United States when it is fully complicit with Israel in perpetuating a genocide in Gaza? In my opinion, there is none. Now, returning to Anzac Day commemorations, your question is highly relevant. Indeed, how can we protect Anzac Day as an occasion devoted to reflection and mourning and prevent it from becoming a political tool or a justification of future bloodbaths? Well, the one thing we can do is to elect parliamentary representatives who are committed to an independent and peaceful foreign policy and who demand of the Australian government that it becomes a champion of peace, diplomacy and reconciliation in our region and around the world, including in the United Nations. Being recognised as a champion of peace will help to diminish the country's obsession with military commemoration and discredit the view that our engagement in foreign wars has been a defining collective experience.
Thank you, John, for coming on to Rights, Thoughts and Rants. Blue Mountains Unions and Community, which hosts this show, is in support of your event, and you'll probably see our banner there. And we hope it is a peaceful and successful day.
Thank you again, Deb, for the opportunity.
Okay, so that was John Atkins of the Blue Mountains Peace Collective, who's given us a lot to contemplate on Anzac Day and before Anzac Day. We hope you'll be able to attend the Peace Collective's Anzac Day reflection. And just a reminder, it's at 2 o'clock on Anzac Day in the Peace Park opposite the Council Chambers in Katoomba.